Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Kevin from a Design for Living group in Neptune, New Jersey.
How you doing? My name is Kevin and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Jeff. My sobriety date is April 20th of 2015. I just want to thank the group for asking me to come out and Jeff for asking me to speak. So I just want to say Jeff's name so in case there's any problems or issues, you know, you could go see him tonight. And if there isn't, my ego really likes an attaboy, so I'll take those as well. That was supposed to be funny. You guys can laugh. Thanks, guys. So, my home group is Designed for Living, and you'll know I'm a home group member by the actions I take there. You know, I've done various tours throughout that group, and I have a sponsor. Most of the time, he knows he's my sponsor by the actions I take and the conversations we have. And trust me, sometimes I've been up at this podium at different places and he actually has no idea what's going on in my life, but today I am current with my sponsor. So, you know, I don't have an extravagant story, so if you guys are expecting one, you know, you hear a lot of the same things, but the funny thing is with this alcoholic ego that I have, you know, I'm on the way here, you know, it's about an hour and a half drive, and it's like, they're not going to like what you have to say. Nobody's going to be able to relate. You know, they're going to laugh at you. They're going to look down upon you. And you know what? That same voice was the same voice I had at 6 years old. Tell me that I'm different from all of you. I couldn't connect. I'm just different. I feel weird. And it carried on. And then one day, you know, I discovered alcohol. Bill said it perfectly in his story. I discovered alcohol. Normal people don't say that whatsoever at all. You know, they talk about like discovering a new like solar system or a new species. No normal temperate drinker out there says, I discovered alcohol, but the effect it had on me, I still remember that day. I can't remember yesterday, for a matter of fact, but I remember the day that I felt the effect produced by alcohol. You know, I was 14 years old, me and a couple buddies of mine, I live right by the beach, so, you know, we figured, you know, to have some drinks, we'll go on to the Point Pleasant Boardwalk, you know, we're young guys, we figured try and go talk to some girls, and that didn't go off as planned. You know, we're kind of on the buddy system because two guys were a little bit more drunk than the other. You know, one person got arrested that night. I ended up getting picked up by my friend's parents. I still remember to this day, you guys smell like a brewery was the first thing she said to us. Then, you know, you better get home. You better tell your mother what you guys did tonight. And I get home, start throwing up into my laundry basket full of clean clothes, start doing laundry at 6 o'clock in the morning. My mother's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I figured you'd get an early start on the day, you know, just that lying and manipulation going on, and I loved what it did for me. It changed the course of my life. I felt okay for the first time. You know, I've heard numerous speakers say it, but I can absolutely relate. You know, I took my first, like, deep breath, my full breath, and I didn't care what anybody thought about me, because I'm the guy who would come into a classroom setting around that time, and I know you're talking about me. You know, I hear some laughter halfway across the room. They probably don't even know I'm in the room. And, oh, man, what's going on? Do I have something on my shirt? Do I have something in my teeth? You know, this that self-centeredness that everything was constantly about me. And it carried in for my entire life up until high school. You know, same things. This always felt different, always felt less than. And the occasions that I could drink, everything changed. I really believe that I was very active in high school when it came to sports, and I believe that's what kept me alive and kept me sober. I'm not a guy who can live up here too long. The darkness that entails, that comes quickly. My mind just drifts, and it's always doom and gloom. It's never anything positive what's going on. It's always telling me, you're never going to amount to anything. You're never going to do this. You're never going to do that. You know, that fear. I've been so fear-based my entire life. It's robbed me of many things. You know, it robbed me of job opportunities. Women, forget about it. You know where my mind goes when I see a pretty girl at school? This is before I even approach her. We're going to get married. She doesn't know it yet. We're going to have two kids. You know, we're going to have the white picket fence. We're probably going to have like a dog named Charlie or something. Two-car garage, two cars. And, you know, things are going to go well for a couple years. You know, probably like 4 or 5 years. You know, one day I'm going to come home early to surprise her. I'm going to see Johnny from next door walking out the door. Next thing you know, I'm getting divorced. She's getting the house and the kids. I'm going to have to get some crappy little apartment down the road. So, you know, all this very fake, obviously, but it's real enough to me that I don't even go up and approach her. But when that effect produced by alcohol that Dr. Silkworth describes perfectly in the doctor's opinion, everything's okay. I don't care. I'll go up to that girl. You know, I don't care. I'll probably be a virgin to this day if it wasn't for alcohol. You know? Yeah. It is what it is. But, you know, my alcoholism really didn't take off until I got to college. You know, I lost my father at a very early age when I was 6 years old. And, you know, I had to, I guess, become the man of the house at a very early age. You know, whatever my mother needed to make sure my brothers were okay. You know, chores around the house, laundry, this and that. And when I went away to college, all bets are off. You know, I could finally drink the way I wanted to drink because the excuses I was pulling in high school was like, well, you're 17 years old and you can drive. Why do you have to stay over such and such house tonight? You know, and that was all out the window. I could drink the way I wanted to drink, and man, did it take off. You know, I go from a guy probably drinking 5 or 6 times in high school to 3 weeks in the college, a Tuesday afternoon, a buddy of mine who I, you know, just met in a few weeks is knocking on my dorm room. Hey, you know, we're going down to the rec center to play basketball. And I'm sitting there doing a power hour by myself. You guys know what a power hour is? Take a shot of beer every minute for an hour? Yeah? No? Okay, I see a couple head nods. Some people are paying attention. So I'm like, dude, I got 30 minutes left here. You're going to have to wait. And I made him wait. You know, I went and played. But you see what? Alcohol was starting to play an important part in my life right there and then. And of course, I don't see this coming at all. You know, alcohol, I can't get up here and say that I didn't have a great time drinking. I'd be lying to all of you. You know, alcohol made me feel connected. It brought me into life. It made me feel okay. And then slowly but surely, consequences starting to take place. A couple things that come to mind. I don't want to go into a huge drunk log or anything like that. But I think it's very important to talk about the drink. So I remember being away at college. Well, actually, I was pretty much the guy on the couch at college at this point. You know, I kind of crashed and burned after that first semester because I couldn't stop partying. I couldn't stop drinking. So I decided to live on my friend's couch rent-free, as long as he could use my car as often as they wanted. But it was St. Patrick's Day. I was 21. I had court that day. My mother had to drop me back off at the house I was staying at. And just like a kid on Christmas Eve, you know, when you're 6 years old and you can't sleep, that's what it was. I just couldn't wait to get to the city. I couldn't wait to partake in all the fun, all the activities, all the drinking that was going to happen that day. And I was on this kind of hippie stage back then. You wouldn't tell by my short hair now, but I had very long hair. I liked to indulge in some other stuff at that time and listen to a lot of reggae music. It probably doesn't look like that now, but, you know, that's how it was. And I go to the city, we start drinking at 6 a.m., doing car bombs and Irish coffees. 10 a.m., I'm at my fourth bar in Manhattan. You know, 2 p.m., we're at in some other borough. And finally, you know, me and this one kid who we were put together that day because, like I said, you know, I was on this hippie stage. I didn't have a cell phone. So me and Eric were buddies that day because nobody wanted to deal with me and Eric because people knew at that time when me and Eric got together, you know, things usually got out of hand. So, we both look at each other and we're like, you know, we need to get out of here now. We're not going to make it out of New York if we don't. So, you know, we hop on the train. We're like, all right, we'll go back to the liquor store. We'll get a couple things that we need to finish off the rest of the alcohol at home, and we'll go to happy hour. So we do that and go back and start drinking. And I don't know what happened. I blacked out on the way to happy hour. I started punching in the back of the head in the car ride down. I had a $20 bill in my hand. I jumped out, and I attended Seton Hall University for that, well, it sounds good, for that 1 year, but I started running around downtown South Orange trying to hand people $20 bills. I guess I was in a generous blackout or something. Man, nobody's laughing at all. I guess I'm a lot funnier than I think. So, you know, cops come. I have no idea. You know, I have people who witnessed this and told me what happened, and a cop jacked me up against the wall and gave me an ultimatum. He's like, you either go to the precinct and sleep this off, or you could go to the hospital. So I said, I'll go to the hospital. Then I proceeded to call shotgun on the ambulance and run to the front of it. Nobody knows what shotgun is either. Jeez, man. I'm going to stop, like, attempting to be funny, I guess. It's just not working. But, you know, the story doesn't stop there. You know, I get taken to the hospital. I see that I'm not handcuffed to anything. I see there's some exit signs around the place. So I'm like, okay, cool. You know, I'm not strapped down. Let's get out of here. So I get out and I start walking. I'm decked out in green. Like I mentioned at St. Patrick's Day, I look like a person you don't want to see at all. You know, you wouldn't want to stop for help and anything like that. So I get out, I start walking. Of course, I'm walking the wrong way. And the funny thing is, you know, I was getting down on my hands and knees praying at cars. Please, somebody stop. God, please put somebody in my path. And it's kind of funny, you know, I grew up, I was brought to church. You know, I was introduced to God at an early age. But when it came to God, I swore him off. But when in jackpots, you know, it's the first person I go to. And finally, this car stops. I'm like, thank God. And then 2 seconds later, I'm patting myself on the back. Here you go, Kev. You got out of that one again. And get to talk and stuff like that. Just like where you're from, blah, blah, blah. So going back and forth. And come to find out, Eric and this kid, Eric was with the entire day. Eric was punching in the back of the head probably 2 hours ago. These guys knew each other. They were friends. They went to high school together. You know, and he proceeded to drop me back off. And, you know, of course, like any good alcoholic, I'm like, you know, I'm awake now. Go out, continue to drink, you know, go do some non-conference approved substances. And then I went out and enjoyed the rest of my night. And I associated with every college kid in America who was doing that at this time. You know, that's why I had no idea what was going on in my life. I had no idea these certain consequences that was starting to build up. You know, that was all in fun, you know. But then slowly, surely after that, it's, you know, crashing cars starting to happen, falling asleep on the parkway, the Garden State Parkway, going 65 miles an hour, waking up between a sign. You know, calling my stepfather at that time at 2 o'clock in the morning, can you come get me? And as soon as I get in this car, I fall asleep. They're just asking me, were you drunk last night? Like, no, the adrenaline was pumping, you know, and it wore off and I fell asleep. It's constantly lying. You know, it took a point. It took a turning point that I went from being happy, joyous, and free to the point that I wanted to take my own life. You know, I'm praying to God that I wouldn't wake up the next day. Because I was just sick and tired of the life I was living. You know, there was no outside circumstance that would fix me, and I tried my best to acquire those things. You know, she's going to fix me, or I get this job, it's going to fix me. You know, I get the car, it's going to fix me. You know, it's just, you know, people talk about that hole in the soul and, you know, God's the only one that can fill it. And, you know, after doing some step work with my sponsor, I think God made me perfect the way it was. I just think this ego of mine told me that I was missing something my entire life. But I believe he made me whole from the moment of creation for me. So like I said, you know, I started to acquire these things. Things started to get better in my life. And then it would crash and burn, you know. I get to the point where I'm army crawling in the middle of the night, taking money out of my stepfather's wallet, taking money out of my mom's wallet, just so I could go feel okay. And at this point, alcohol really wasn't working, but I needed my medicine because it was the only thing that treated my alcoholism. When I drank, this shut off. The mind shut off, and I felt okay. And when I was separated from it, you know, that obsession as described in the doctor's opinion was full force. And of course, you know, I don't know any of these things until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember reading that doctor's opinion for the first time and I was just blown away. You know, it's not good stuff in the doctor's opinion if you're relating to that, you know. But for me, it was some comfort. It's like, ah, there you go. That's why you're doing this. But it's also not enough to keep me from drinking. So, you know, I'll get into that a little bit more. So I finally got the job. My uncle stuck his neck out on the line for me for this water company that he's been working for about 35 years. And, surprised I still have that job. I was operating the forklift at work under the influence, and I took out a garage door. So there's strike one. I'm on my probation phase at work. Probably just hired about 2 weeks ago at the time, that is. And, fast forward 2 weeks, I'm driving the company vehicle, and my company truck, I should say, my supervisor told me after taking out the garage door at the forklift, if you get in an accident, if you put a scrape, a scratch, whatever on this truck, don't even bother coming into work the next day. So I'm driving the truck. It's in bad weather. I'm supposed to be going 40 minutes south. I'm going 40 minutes north for some other stuff because, like I said, I had to be under the influence of something at this point. I couldn't draw a sober breath. I couldn't deal with reality ever. So I'm going the wrong way. I'm going up the parkway, and I take out some guy's side view mirror of his brand new truck, and the ego starts going, "Kevin, you can outrun him. Kevin, you don't need to pull over. You could burn him in this thing." Mind you, this thing has a cap on it. I can't go over 74 miles an hour on the truck. But that's the story that's going in my head. And after like dragging this guy along for a couple miles, I pull over. He's like, "What the hell are you doing?" I didn't see a safe place to pull over. I'm sorry about that. It's the first thing I say to him. So, you know, we get to talking. And matter of fact, this is brother's truck. And I, you know, play the sad story of, "I just got in an accident with the forklift. I'm going to get fired. Can we please work this out?" You know, he hands me his phone, calls his brother. We come to an agreement. This happened on a Friday. By Sunday, I checked myself into a treatment facility for the first time. And I still remember that, you know, that Sunday, telling my mother what's going on, asking her, "I need to go somewhere today. I'm not going to make it till tomorrow." You know, I was just, the thought of losing that job, you know, it's so funny, is what kept me away from previous times, because I was brought to drug and alcohol counselors, and those therapists are coming out and telling my mother, you know, giving her a little glimmer of hope that everything's going to be okay. Your son's a little caught up at the moment. You know, I really don't see that big of an issue of what's going on. And because I can't tell the truth, you know, I, like it says, I don't know if it's more about alcoholism or one alcoholic in it. Gotta go verbatim here because I'm horrible at quoting things, but you know, no one can reach an alcoholic like an alcoholic can, you know, and they're coming out trying to give this glimmer of hope to her, and I'm just lying through my teeth, and they can't even see it, you know, you just want the money. You know, "Come back in 2 weeks, we'll talk some more, yada, yada, yada." But finally, my hands are thrown up. I'm like, "I need to go somewhere today. I can't take another day of this." And I told my mother, we had some family over at the time. Matter of fact, it was my aunt and uncle, who both have over 20 years in this fellowship. And I told her I'm going out to get some toothpaste, a toothbrush, some deodorant, some shampoo. I come home 3 hours later. Had to go out for the last drink. Had to survive the car ride. Had to survive that first night away, knowing that I won't have my medicine, that crutch, that thing that I always go back to every morning. No matter how many times I swear off that I'm not going to do it again. And I still remember walking through those doors, her crying, her starting to hit me, just punching me, yelling at me, "You know we had to be there by this time. It's so many hours away." I just didn't care. You know, that's how powerful this thing is, that I want to get well. I'm begging for help. And I'm just kind of like, you know, I'll get there when I get there. You know, that self-centeredness, doing things my way all the time. So she drives me down there and drops me off. And that first morning I wake up, I'm in so much agony and pain. And I'm thinking, "Whoa, Kevin, you overreacted with that one, buddy. It wasn't really that bad. What are you doing here? What did you just get yourself into?" And that's been the course of my life, the resurgence of the ego. This over and over again telling me it's going to be a different story. You know, I was listening to something today, and it said, drunk thoughts, but a sober mind or something like that. And I just, for some reason, when I heard those words, I pictured that point in my life right there, you know, asking for help. And then that's the resurgence of that ego the following day saying, "Well, what did you just get yourself into?" So I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was at that point. No idea. I had no idea what STEPS was. And luckily for my sake, this was a very big book oriented place that I went to down in South Jersey. And you know, H&I commitments would come in, and if there's anybody who does H&I in this room, my hats are off to you, because if folks like yourself who came into the facility that I was at and other facilities absolutely saved my life, because I was always comparing myself. You know, I thought an alcoholic was a guy sleeping under a bridge in a trench coat with, like, you know, a 40 in a brown paper bag, and I didn't think I was an alcoholic. But people started coming and sharing their experience, and I'm starting to identify, and as asleep in my own life I was, I knew that, you know, I need to get out and get a sponsor. So I remember calling my mother, and I'm like, can you talk to Uncle John and hook me up with a sponsor, you know, for when I get out of here? You know, I'm connected. I hooked myself up with an Oxford house to go to, because I was too afraid to go back to my area. You know, I'm right at smack down at the Jersey Shore. You know, I was getting out, I think, Memorial Day weekend. The last place I wanted to be was in my town. So, you know, fast forward those 30 days. I get out. I get this guy's number, and what do? Don't call him. It's not that bad. You know, I'm in a sober living house now. I just met a couple roommates. You know, everybody's cool. You know, everything's off my back. My parents took care of that side view mirror for me. My job's taking me back. You know, I'm starting to meet some people at the meetings I'm going to. And thought I was cured. You know, I thought I had it. Thankfully, this rehab that I went to, they forced me to set up an IOP appointment. They wouldn't give me completion of it unless I had an IOP appointment set up. So I'm going to this place. It's like probably the second week I'm there, and I hear this kid talking, and he's talking about Asbury Park and Long Branch, New Jersey. And it was like 5 minutes from where I lived. And, you know, I'm like, oh, wow, I really need to go talk to this guy afterwards. So, you know, he's done talking. It ends. And I go up to him afterwards. He's like, hey, man, it's 8:25. There's an 8:30 meeting I'm going to right now. Like, let's go. I'm like, okay. So, you know, I go to the meeting with him. After the meeting, he introduces me to this kid, Dave. He's like, hey, this is a buddy of mine. Like, you know, do you have a sponsor yet, Kevin? I'm like, no, I don't have a sponsor. And the kid, Dave, is like, I could take you through the work. Absolutely not my game plan. I was not looking for a sponsor that night. But you know what? I was kind of wanted to fit in with all of you. You know, I was going to meetings, hearing about sponsorship and stuff like that. I'm like, you know, I felt like the outcast my entire life. So out of fear, you know, I went along with it. So, you know, he told me to start calling him every day. So I would start calling him like once a week, because overtime became prevalent at this time. You know, because that's going to solve it. I just need to get a lot of cash, you know, bring up the bank account a little bit, get the apartment, you know, move out of the Oxford house, get on my own, and everything will be okay. I'm going to 7 meetings a week. My sponsors call me, like, let's sit down for step work. It's like, hey, man, I'm working the 6:30 tonight. I won't be back in RA to 7:30. I just don't think it's going to work tonight. And I started doing this over the course of a couple weeks, about a month, and this is where I'm going to steal Jeff's line that I heard him say. I'm sitting there at work, and the noise is starting to build, you know, day by day at this point. But I'm sitting at the work, and I'm stealing his line. But it's like walking into Best Buy. You're going into the electronics section. The TVs are all in different channels, and the volume's turned all the way up. You know, that's what my head felt. It felt like an IBM processor. Things just flying in and out of it. If you asked me how I was doing, A, I probably would say I'm good. But the reality of it is I couldn't even tell you what I was thinking at that point. I was starting to get crazy. You know, I felt insane. And I remember one night afterwards getting honest with my sponsor. I was probably working with him for a month tonight. You know, we did 1, 2, 3, and he told me to go write my fourth step a little bit before that. I wrote down about 8 names on that first column, and then I stopped because I'm good. And then a week later, I want to kill myself. And I didn't get that. You know, I thought once I put the drink down, all my problems were going to be solved. I thought everything was going to be okay. And then that night, I heard my current sponsor speak. He was doing the fourth and fifth step, and he rocked me to my core that night. Changed my life. Talking about the fear, the resentment, the harm caused, and being sober and clear-headed for the first time in a very long time, all these emotions started to race to me. I remember going up to him after the meeting and just saying to him, I don't want to die. Because there's a line in a book that talks about, you know, the jumping off point. You know, either I can go on to the bitter end or I accept spiritual help. And at that moment, you know, I asked for help. And he started me off very simply, you know, call me tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Then he started giving me some names of guys who lived out of state, you know, and leading up into this, you know, like I was saying, I had kind of sort of had a sponsor. I'm going to 7 meetings a week. I'm doing some step work. You know, that's what my ego is telling me. It's like, Kevin, you're doing AA. Like, what's going to be different with this guy? But I just started listening. I started listening to him. You know, we started meeting Tuesday nights at 7 o'clock at his house. We started going page by page. You know, he really pulled me out of the gates of hell, that guy. I was ready to drink. I was ready to end it all. And he invites me into his home. You know, asked me if I wanted, you know, wanted a water, a seltzer water, if I was hungry, if I wanted a meal. He just made me feel welcome. And the beautiful thing is, he didn't want any money for it. He just accepted me. And that's what I started to see in Alcoholics Anonymous, seeing all you guys with guys and girls with smiles on your face and sober and just walking in the meeting, seeing people sitting down doing step work over there or talking over there. And I was like, I fell in love with it. I started to fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I haven't felt the need to have a drink or any mind and mood altering substance since I came in here. This is hopefully my first and only go around. And the only reason I say that is because I felt out of place for a while in Alcoholics Anonymous. Coming here, people talking about relapses and their stories, and I kind of felt like, you know what, maybe I'm not one of you guys. And I'm not saying that I'm better for this or anything like that. A relapse is not part of my story. You know, I tried on numerous occasions to do this thing on my own. I just couldn't do it. So I changed my home group. I started driving up 45 minutes north to Neptune, New Jersey, the town I was trying to avoid. How funny is that? Made my home group Design for Living. You get in a commitment. He's like, I don't care if they're filled. You're going to start greeting every Sunday. I want you in a shirt and tie. He was really testing me. He wanted to see how willing I was. You know, that's what he said to me afterwards. He's like, I normally never make anybody wear a shirt and tie to greet, but he's like, I wanted to see how desperate you were to get well. You know, I started hopping in the cars, you know, hanging out with the boys, going up to different meetings, traveling around, getting introduced to a lot of fun things, because I don't think if I found any fun here, I wouldn't have stayed. You know, a lot of great blessings have come to me from just saying yes. I've been out to retreats in Las Vegas. I went to a retreat in Nashville, Tennessee this year. Weekends in Philly, weekends in New York. I just wanted to come in here and maybe learn how to drink, you know, successfully, and like just do it on the weekends. You know, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. But, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of work I had to do. And, you know, that fourth and fifth step, putting everything out in the line. But let me backtrack for a second. I think the thing that really catapulted me was that third step with my sponsor. You know, he slowly started introducing me into prayer and meditation and stuff like that. And the third step really knocked me off my socks. And, you know, we get down there, you know, we read how it works. We do the third step prayer. And then he asked me, he's like, well, you know, how do you turn your care and life over to God, or your will and your life over to God? I'm like trying to think of this really profound answer for him. You know, I'm trying to like sponsor my sponsor with this question. And he just looks at me. He's like, buddy, stop thinking before you hurt yourself. So he asked me a couple questions. He asked me, do you have a sponsor? I'm like, yes. Do you have a home group? Yes. Do you do service in that home group? Yes. Do you do service outside the home group? Yes. He's like, buddy, you're an alcoholic. You're not wired to do any of that. If that's not doing God's will, I don't know what is. And I just started thinking about that. You know, I started to tear up a little bit. And then he's like, let's start on that inventory. And I was so willing to do it this time. Like I said, I had a sponsor before. You know, I thought I had it. You know, I started writing a couple names down. And then at this point, I was just so broken, so ready to get well. I started crying when he told me I could do my fourth step. Like, that might sound a little crazy to some of you out there who've done one, or the stories you hear about people saying this horrible, tough thing to do. But I was so welcomed by it. You know, I just wanted to get it over with and do it and move on with the process. And, I did, and it was very freeing, you know. It was really tough to look at how I was showing up in life, drunk or sober. You know, there's definitely some sober things on there that I was ashamed to say to him. I don't want to tell anybody things I want to take to the grave with me. And like you said, hey buddy, the only thing that's going to hurt is you. It's not going to hurt me if you keep anything in. You know, so after a long, grueling 7.5 hours, you know, we did 6 and 7 right away. You know, I thought it was a one-shot deal in the beginning. I didn't know I was going to have to keep continuing to bring God into my life. Or, you know, I thought it was going to be like white as snow from that moment on. I learned the hard way at times. You know, go on to 8, rate that list, and then 9. I always like touching on this amends because the pain and suffering I put my mother through, you know, that amends is, like I said, I would army crawl in the middle of the night to take money out of her purse. She was so upset with me, crying, hitting me, going away to treatment, just the sleepless nights. The horrible, you know, the phone call she was expecting any time I left the house that her son was either in jail, killed somebody, or killed himself. And just to sit down and make it right and not say I'm sorry. Because I said I'm sorry so many times, it holds no depth and weight at all whatsoever. So I remember sitting down with her, it was right around Christmas time, and I said, Mom, I can't believe to know the pain that I put you through. I really seem to have broken that innocent bond between a mother and a son. And if there's anything I can do to make it right, you know, please, from the bottom of my heart, I will do anything. So, of course, she's crying, I'm crying. And it's right around Christmas time. And a couple weeks later at Christmas, you know, she has a small little box for me. She hands it to me. It's my father's wedding band. Like I said in the beginning, my father passed away at 6 years old. And being the oldest child, I knew I was entitled to it. I just never expected to get it. You know, I was 6 months sober at the time, and I guess she saw a different glimmering in my eye at that point that she trusted me enough to give that to me. And, you know, I'm wearing it tonight. I usually like to wear it when I speak to have, you know, my father with me at this moment looking over me, as he always is. But just that moment to see the Alcoholics Anonymous and God was absolutely working in my life. Because I wouldn't have this, or I wouldn't have that relationship. I wouldn't have made that amends to her. You know, if I went on doing the things I wanted to do in Alcoholics Anonymous without that, without getting a sponsor, and getting to that point, that brokenness in sobriety, that desperation in sobriety, I probably would have just carried on doing what Kevin wanted to do. You know, but thank God I took that third step that I was talking about earlier. I had a new employer at that point. You know, he is the principal and I am the agent. And through course of action, you know, I started to go out and make things right with her, with my brothers, and started to get the family back, and people were inviting me around. You know, it used to be, Kevin, it's good to see you. It's been 6 years since I saw you at the last family Thanksgiving. Or, Kevin, where were you? You know, you've missed Christmas Eve so many years in a row, and now people are calling me and like, hey, it's good to see you. I'm just not used to that, you know. I'm used to like, please don't ever contact me again. So, you know, I went on to the other steps, you know, 10 and 11 and 12, 10. You know, it's hard to keep taking a look at yourself at times. You know, I really don't like to look for arms, continue to be selfish and dishonest and stuff like that. Prayer, meditation, you know, I have ups and downs with. I don't do it perfectly, but I can tell you when I am neglecting those two things in particular more than anything, I'm often making amends to coworkers. Because I go up, the ego puffs up at work, and Kevin wants to run the show, and I know how to do it better than you. And mind you, I'm like the newest employee in my department, by the way. There's two guys who've been there 35 years and another guy who's been there 18, and I just know how to do everything better than all of you, is what my ego puffs up to when I'm neglecting continuing to look at myself and bringing God into it and looking at those 24 hours ahead and not connecting with him throughout the day. You know, alcoholics are undisciplined by nature, so what do a guy like me do? I started setting alarms on my phone at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. every day to pause, so I could calmly reflect and bring God back into my day. Because a lot of the time I like to start off my day, like I said, Kevin likes to roar his ugly head and start ticking off some coworkers. And then the biggest blessing has been sitting down with another man just as broken as me, sharing my experience with him, really connecting, and then starting to see their lights turn on in their eyes, seeing them starting to get their family members together and back and wanted in their life, seeing them get their kids back. That's an absolute blessing. For like a guy like me, I didn't think it was possible. I was deathly afraid of sponsorship. I remember I'm telling my sponsor, I'm like, I'm going to kill somebody. He's like, you can't keep them sober and you can't keep them drunk. Let's see how much I'm on time. And the biggest thing for me now, being almost about 2.5 years sober, is continuing to do this stuff. Continuing not listening to the resurgence of the ego telling me it's okay to take this night off, or, you know, you could pass this, you could pass off this IOP commitment this month, or you don't need to answer that phone call. You know, it's going to be the typical BS that so-and-so is giving you. It's late at night. You know, Netflix is way more important. And that's the biggest thing for me, is continuing to take that third step prayer that I said that was so very important to me in the beginning. Am I doing God's will or mine? And some days I do okay with that, and some days I don't. You know, I was talking with Jeff a little before. I was hurt a little bit, you know, the whole sponsorship thing. I was working with a guy for 7 or 8 months, and he just fell off the face of the earth with me. A guy who I got to know pretty well, a guy who made and went out and did a huge chunk of his amends, and we were really starting to get into the work, and then he just faded away. And it's sad to see. I've seen that with a lot of people so far, and I've only been in here about 2.5 years, and I've seen people at the Oxford House who I was tight with, very close with, who brought me to some of my earliest meetings, and to hear that they're out there drinking again. People that who are sponsoring people at times, is that's like really the baffling part of this disease. Is just knowing this stuff and kind of sort of living it half-assed, excuse my language, is going to slowly but surely bring me out of these rooms. But, you know, I have a story to tell, and I know I'm a little late on time here, but I think this really hits home, and I'll end with this. There's a story of the good wolf and bad wolf. I don't know if any of you have heard this, but it's particularly hit home to me when I heard this, and I was crazy enough to get this tattooed on my leg, by the way, so I'll show you afterwards if you want to see. But so a grandson's having this conversation with his grandfather, an old Cherokee chief. And he goes to him, and the grandfather tells him, I've got this fight going on inside me, and it's going on inside you and everybody else. This good wolf and bad wolf. The good wolf is, you know, happiness, joyous, freedom. And the bad wolf, everything malicious, fear-based, ego, resentment, harm. And the young kid says to his grandfather, well, if this fight's going on inside of everybody, including myself, who wins? And the wise chief replies, whatever wolf you feed. Thank you, guys.
The group would like to thank Kevin for speaking, sharing his experience with us tonight. Let's give him another hand. The group...
All right, Brigham, you want to do 15 minutes? Come on.
Hi, everybody. My name is Brigham. I'm an alcoholic. That was a surprise. I was kind of like relaxing against that post over there. I like to sit over there. Okay, so... feel like I'm actually going to fall over. So, I guess the, man, this is so weird because I'm starting 15 minutes and I have to do, what, my whole story? No. So let's just talk about where I'm at right now. Where I'm at right now is I'm getting plugged back into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, which for people that know me that are here, which I think is only a couple people, might sound like a little bit of a surprise because I've been around AA a lot for the past year at least, but I haven't felt plugged in. I was the chair of a committee that just hosted a Young People's Convention in Bethlehem about a month ago, or less than that, 3 weeks ago. And I was a part of one of the three important legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the legacy of service. And I was, you know, putting in a lot of work week after week, and then eventually became day after day and hour after hour into making sure that this conference really went well. And as I went along, I slowly but surely fell out of the recovery and the unity aspects of the triangle. And, you know, the reason that I'm telling you this is because I think it's one of the most important things for me about recovery and today and kind of forever has been just being completely and totally honest, not just with myself, but with the people around me. You know, I'm reading this this book by a guy named Sandy Beach. He's a pretty well-known member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he passed away recently. He wrote this little meditation book called Dear Friend. And there's these little meditations about different topics, and you read them two or three times in the morning and then again at night, and you do a little reflection each day. Then at the end, you think about your last thoughts. And the one about this week is honesty. And it talks about how at first when I got sober, I had to become honest because I couldn't stand the guilt and the shame and the remorse that I felt when I wasn't honest with you. And then I had to become honest because honestly conducting myself helps me to build better relationships with other people. And then it became, I had to be honest because if I'm not honest, then I can't hope to approach my higher power at the end of the night or throughout the day and actually build a relationship with that higher power. And then eventually, this is something that was new for me, and I just started reading it on Sunday or Saturday. It said that the next level of honesty is seeking out the places where I'm still ignorant, the places where I'm not being honest, the places where I don't know things, and finding and seeking the things that are blocking me from the truth and from reality. And I thought that was really profound, and it kind of struck me right between the eyes, and I realized that even more than I have been, it's not for me to just be honest with the things that I have done in my past, but also to continue to seek a higher level of honesty and of reality. And anyway, that was a little tangent, but what's been going on with me is I have to be in all three legacies of the triangle, man. I just really do, because when I'm not in recovery, when I'm not doing 10, 11, and 12, when I'm not growing through those steps and helping other people and remaining firm in my foundation, what happens is I'll start to backslide and I'll start to unwork the 12 steps and I'll fall down them. I heard somebody say it recently, and that's just my story in a nutshell. You know, this isn't the first time that I got sober. I was one of the guys that relapsed, and I relapsed a handful of different times. The first time I got sober, I stayed for 3.5 years. And I drank at the end of that because I was falling out of the legacies just in a different way. You know, I stopped going to meetings because I didn't think I needed to learn anything from you people. I wasn't really doing recovery because I thought I already knew everything about the steps, and I had already worked them, and I had already found out all the deep, dark secrets of myself, and I had shoved them to the side to not think about them ever again. And you know, service, well, you guys had given me a good amount, but I thought I gave a good enough amount back, so why did I need to keep giving? So I drifted out of AA, and it was no surprise that in 3.5 years I drank. It was a surprise to me, but not to anybody else around me, you know? And what happened was, slowly but surely, I was bludgeoned back into AA, you know? The first time it took about a year, and I came back into AA, only to assume that I knew everything and to tell all of you that I knew everything pretty much through my actions, if not my words, and to promptly relapse in about a month or two. And then it took me about 6 months to get back to AA. And then 2 months. And then like 30 seconds, you know, because I got beaten to a state of reasonableness. Not reasonableness to accept help in the first place, but reasonableness to accept the fact that I probably didn't know everything and that I needed help and that I needed to admit that I probably wasn't ever going to be able to figure it out on my own. And that's a level of honesty that I had never achieved before. That level of honesty has carried me through these past like 3.5 years because without it, I never would have been able to recognize a couple months ago that people that I had once considered my friends 6 or 7 months before, I now thought of as my enemies, people getting in the way of what I wanted, what I needed. And what I wanted and I needed was no longer like financial, like material possessions or things, really. It was to be the head honcho, to be the person that was respected in my committee, to be the people that my committee, you know, to be the person that ran things. All the people that went to Pensacola are like, oh my God, this is terrifying. You know, and like this is how I felt. I oscillated between feeling the way that I feel like I was supposed to and this way on a daily basis, sometimes an hourly basis. And I was dying. I was dying. I was rotting from the inside out. I had no unity, you know. I didn't want to be around these people because I knew that they could see that I was a fraud. And I didn't want to be around these people because I, you know, had stepped on their toes. They retaliated. Or sometimes I didn't even retaliate. I just kept stepping on their toes. And I had to eventually just realize what I had done and what I had become, and that I had slowly but surely worked my way out of recovery. And you know, now I'm in this long, gross process of admitting that 3.5 years sober, I was just as like kind of ugly as I was when I was drinking, you know, which is never a nice place to be. It's the place that I got to when I drank the last time. And I think I'm being a little bit too hard on myself, maybe. But that's where I was, you know, that I was back in that direction. And when I'm moving in that direction, it goes way faster than I would ever expect. And I was just talking with the guy before the meeting about how thank God for AA and thank God for this commitment that I had, that I thought was the center of all of my woes, that I thought was the center of all my stress, of all my fear, of all my resentment. And if only I wasn't a part of this, if only I could just quit, if only I wasn't convinced by my sponsor and everyone around me that I can't ever, you know, abandon an AA commitment, then I would just be happy and I'd be fine and I'd be free and I wouldn't be so resentful. And I took everything that was going on inside of me and I put it on everyone else again. Again, sober. You know, worked 12 steps, had a spiritual awakening. Was doing the deal, like hardcore for a while. And then I start to wonder, why don't I have that many sponsees anymore? What happened to them? Where are they? Why did people stop asking me to sponsor them? Why did people stop asking me to speak in meetings? Why did people stop calling me for advice? You know? And then I started thinking, when's the last time that I called somebody for advice? Man, when's the last time that I even really did a 10th or 11th step? When's the last time that I really prayed and I felt that feeling sweep over me? And the terrifying part was I realized that, and then I spent probably 2 or 3 months trying to get that back, scrambling against it, and I was certain that I was going to drink again. I was absolutely certain that 3 years in, I was going to drink again. I was going to fail again at the same place that I did before. And, you know, this time I was probably going to die. And I was really actually pretty convinced. But something that stuck with me was something that I discovered around a year and a half in. And I was having not a similar problem, but I was still in the kind of place where, you know, I felt recovered, but wasn't really sure. And I was afraid, and I was sponsoring guys for the first time, really. And, you know, I'd call my sponsor and I'd tell him, I think that I'm going to drink again. You know, he'd say, why? And I said, I don't know. I just feel like unbalanced and I feel like I don't have a solid foundation. I feel like there's something wrong. And he said, well, whenever something's wrong in your life today, like, what do you do? I said, well, I usually pray, call you, go to a meeting, try to help somebody, stuff like that. And he goes, well, whenever you had a problem before, what did you do? And I was like, well, I drank, obviously. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I get it, you know. And he was like, no, you don't. Because what that means is that your center has changed. You've received that promise that it talks about in the doctor's bin. You've had an entire psychic change where suddenly, you know, you've gone from alcohol can do for you what you can't do for yourself to now God can do for you what you can't do for yourself. And so you rely on God. The first thing that you call towards is God. You've had that shift. And it just blew my face off. And I had no idea. I thought that I was an inch away from a drink at every single second. And I wasn't, because I was doing what I was supposed to do. And so, you know, this kind of like circle that I've just gone in is regardless of how far away I got at times this past year, my center has remained where it needs to be. You know, and there's been at least enough reflection and enough membership of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've been kept centered when at some of my worst moments I don't want to be centered. I just kind of want to run away again. I kind of want to disappear. And you know, that's kind of the beauty of the spiritual awakening that's the result of the 12 steps is. At times I realize that my higher power is there. At times I realize that my higher power has always been there and always will be there. And at other times I don't. But it doesn't really change the fact that it is there. Guiding me, carrying me. You know, sometimes I have the single reed that's keeping me from drowning. Other times it's the whole loving hand of God sheltering me. And, you know, all I know is that when I can be honest enough with myself to truly take a look at what's going on in my life and admit it to myself and to others, I usually do. And I usually say it out loud and I tell myself and I rant at a meeting or from the podium and people are like, well, that was different. And you know, I don't know if it's different. It's just what I need to do sometimes. And you know, there's other times where, and this is where I am now. You know, I'm back into the steps. I have a new sponsor that I'm, you know, finally starting to do some work with. I have suddenly 6 sponsees that sprouted out of nowhere. You know, I have a home group that I'm an active member in. You know, my life looks pretty good, both in terms of AA and in terms of just other things that don't really mark, you know. Whatever, but you know, it's always a bonus, and this is in 3 weeks that my life is completely turned around, because I've been willing to face myself and try to be rid of the things that are blocking me again. And so, is that an hour? We got like 2 minutes. So, you know, that's why I'm here tonight. That's why I'm gonna go to a meeting tomorrow night. Not the next night, because I have a prior obligation. But, you know, and hopefully the night after that and the night after that. And the one thing that that just shakes me to the core sometimes when I remember it or when I have the joy to hear other people talk about it is... And this is something that came that just kind of struck me across the face last Wednesday in a meeting was how amends is connected to a lot of what I just talked about. And I heard Kevin talk about it, sorry, during the meeting about amends, and what really just struck me about it was the amends are a commitment. They're me making renewing the commitment that I've made to a higher power to try to do God's will and not to care about consequences, and because the consequences don't matter when I'm with God. But
but it's also my ability to go out and hopefully provide somebody the ability to have their own kind of spiritual experience. Because if somebody that I hated walked up to me and they said, "This is all that I've done. Is there anything I can do to make it right?" it would blow my socks off. I've had the joy to have that happen because I know a lot of alcoholics. But you know, and that's something that I've been able to give to other people, is I've been able to go up to them and unabashedly admit every single thing that I've done wrong, when I would have screamed if somebody told me to do that before. And because it doesn't hurt me anymore. It's not guilt and shame anymore. That was taken away when I did a fifth step. I did 6 and 7. You know, now it's just me as one of God's kids going out and saying, "I'm so sorry that I did this, and I am committed to making this right for you." And that, you know, that's the real power of honesty. I don't know how I got on this honesty kick, but that's what it is. So thanks, Jeff, for asking me last minute to speak, and thank you for listening to me, and have a great night.